Hello, and welcome to episode 245 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Recently, while shopping at a local grocery store, I overheard two employees, who they seem to be managers, and they were talking about how hard it's been to hire people. They said their store, along with another location in town, simply could not fill open jobs. That got me thinking about a phrase we heard a lot, especially a couple of years ago, the phrase, nobody wants to work anymore. When I hear that, my reaction is usually, well, nobody wants to work for you. If jobs aren't being filled, that may say less about workers and more about whether those jobs are appealing enough. One easy example are plumbers. That can be difficult and often unpleasant work, but that work pays well. It's work people need, and the market reflects that. But there's also a very different argument. A recent Wall Street Journal column suggests the issue just isn't pay or conditions, but a broader cultural shift that Americans no longer see work as a necessary or even desirable part of life, and that the traditional work ethic has weakened. So, Rick, let's start here. If jobs aren't being filled, do you lay more blame at the feet of workers or employers?
I think it really depends on the job, doesn't it? There are certainly some employers that don't create the necessary kind of working conditions and don't respond enough to market demands and in the right way to attract the employees that they need or to retain good employees when they should be retaining them. But there are also cultural factors at play that might make certain categories of workers unavailable for a time. Things can change. For example, we know that there's been some pretty big demographic shift. There's many fewer kids graduating from or enrolling in schools right now than there was, say, 20 years ago. That means less people available for these temporary summer jobs and a lot of part-time jobs in places like convenience stores and grocery stores and other places that might employ some teenagers. Of course, that creates some market scarcity, and so it might be much harder to attract employees in the same way.
I think everything you said I questioned, except you got to the end, in the same way. And I think that's true, but I think that using my supermarket example is the example here, but it can be overlaid on many different places, that you're right, that these places have relied on for many years finding high schoolers or college-age students who need some extra money to work 15, 20, 25 hours a week doing kind of low-skill jobs so they don't have to pay very much to. And as we've talked about, those young people are often busy doing other things now, maybe don't. There's fewer high school age children in the workforce right now, and again, you can argue whether that's good or bad, but that's like the reality. So if you're a smart operator of a grocery store, it would seem to me would be, well, we're going to have to look at finding other ways to attract people. Maybe we can't rely on or even try to attract, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds, we're going to have to find people who are obviously older, who maybe aren't going to want part-time work. Maybe we're going to have to offer them full-time work. And you know what? That means we may have to offer them benefits. And that may mean we have to devote a little more of our budget to the cost of employing these people. But that is a perfectly okay trade-off. If that means when I go to the grocery store, I'm spending 2 or 3% more on my bill, but like there are people there who are like having decent full-time jobs. I mean, maybe that's like an okay trade-off. And maybe that's like how the market is designed to work. My example with plumbers, there's a world we could live in where like everybody wants to be a plumber and plumbers are like minimum wage jobs. I mean, I guess that would be fine that you can call up and there, you know, at 2 a.m. and you have your faucets leaking. There's people just lining up to come to your house because we have such a huge number of plumbers and not enough work. Well, that's not the world we live in. And so the price of plumbers goes up. And we know that if you call somebody to your house for a plumber, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And that's just like the way life goes.
But then to be a plumber takes a long time of apprenticeship and training, and you have to really know what you're
doing.
Yeah,
versus so, like stocking store shelves. Sure,
right.
That's true.
And so you can, there's all kinds of jobs where you can run into shortages for reasons that are really beyond the employer's control, so that there's simply not sufficient supply there to meet the demand. A lot of hospitals right now are running to a shortage of certain kinds of technicians that have to be really specially trained for certain kinds of jobs that are only in healthcare.
Sure.
And there aren't enough people with those certifications to meet all the demand in the country. So what do? They can't just offer higher wages because that's not the problem.
That's not a short-term fix maybe for those type of things.
No,
yeah.
That's the long-term. But they might already be offering the kind of wages that need to be offered to attract people long-term. It's just that there's this bottleneck right now. And that can happen throughout the economy in a lot of different ways. And so that's why I say it's kind of complicated. Like, there's not a simple answer.
Sure. Like, if there is a scarcity of, like, HVAC technicians, and maybe there is, then I do have a little more – then I think I do have a little more sympathy for the guy or gal who runs an HVAC company having a hard time filling those positions because, you know, you are going to just – fine, you know, unless you want to do a lot of timely and expensive training, you can't just hire somebody off the street. But is it wrong of me to think that, like, to not have much sympathy for, like, the manager of the grocery store to say he can't find anybody? I mean, you know, 90% of American adults have the requisite skills to work at a grocery store in some capacity. I mean, if those people don't want to work for you, that's probably your fault.
So still, I would say yes and no. There are some real demographic changes that you can see sometimes in the complaints about young people not wanting to work that I think have its root in some real causes that we've talked about on the court. One is the time spent on digital devices. That's caused really measurable rates of increasing social anxiety for young people. So there aren't nearly as many young people with the kinds of skills that you would want if you're hiring somebody that's going to engage with the public.
Like a restaurant server, for example.
Like a restaurant server. My wife and I for several years ran a miniature golf course in Colorado, and we would hire high school kids and sometimes college kids that would work that front desk, but we wanted them to be very personable because that's like their...
That's the first impression guests have of your establishment.
Absolutely. And it usually wasn't very hard to find. If we would hire 4 or 5 people every summer. It wasn't always real easy. I think that would be much harder today. It would be harder to find, I think, young people who wanted to be that public-facing and do... like continual interaction with people for an 8-hour shift. That's not a fault of the employers. That's just like changing social conditions that are making it harder to fill those kinds of jobs.
And you were the person who brought up this column in the Wall Street Journal that says there is this broader cultural shift underway that for many people, especially younger people, work is not necessarily at the center of their life. It's not maybe something that is a desirable part of their life, and that this traditional work ethic, I guess the Protestant work ethic is maybe how it was phrased in this article, and we'll link to it, has changed a lot over this past generation or two. And my guess is you buy into some of that.
I do. I think the work... having some kind of work, being able to contribute in a meaningful way to society is a really important part of developing a healthy self-identity. Just last night, because I'm teaching at a university, I have a whole bunch of students that are graduating in 2 weeks. So I asked all my students at the class last night, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Just wanted to get a sense. Do they have a goal set out that far, and what is it? And most of them talked about the kind of work they hope to be doing. And they were enthusiastic in talking. You know, like, they're students now. Many of them have part-time jobs. But their sense of accomplishment and self-worth and purpose in life is really tied up in what kind of job they're going to be doing. I think that's really normal for many people. Most of the young people I interact with have this great sense. On the other hand, I hear more and more about kind of like a lot of despair, especially by a young man at not thinking they're ever going to be able to earn the kind of wages that allow them to live the kind of life that they want to live.
Or maybe that their parents lived.
Or that their parents lived. Also, many of them are gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And when you couple a kind of thought that, like, the economy is not what it used to be, I won't be able to live up to the standards that my parents had and my own expectations, my only shot at getting that is through gambling. And then they become increasingly indebted, which really lowers their incentive to work, because then work is never going to pay off the debts that they have. I think in this country we've greatly underestimated the extent of psychological harm that the widespread legalization of gambling has done to a whole generation of young people.
And this also, I think, folds into what you and others believe is that there's a group of people who don't really value work itself, like that it's, you know, there is generations of people in this country and other countries who would talk about the value of a hard day's work.
And see, that makes sense if you're thinking of it's a ladder that you're moving up. Mm-hmm. And so the work that you're doing is that you're investing in your skills, and your experience. And then you do a certain amount of work and you gain the experience, you gain some kind of credibility, and your reputation is enhanced. You move gradually up the ladder and you can see that you're making progress and you're moving up. But what if the step to the next rung is like 20 feet up? And you can't see yourself. You see yourself going this far, and you can't get any farther. And I think in talking to some young people, like, that's where they see themselves. And then they lose. Why should I keep on investing in this activity that's not going to get me anywhere?
Weirdly, this reminds me of a story I read a long time ago that, you know, if it was the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were a lot of news stories written in newspapers of our biggest cities, not only in this country, I would assume in others, about what are we going to do as these cities are growing so quickly with all the horse manure. Because that was the way people got around, and horse manure is bad and toxic and smelly, and there was just like no answer to what we could do with this. They were just like, we don't know how we're going to solve this problem. Well, what came along? The automobile, and to a lesser extent, public transportation. And there's nobody in big cities today worrying about the problems of horse manure. We have other problems, but we don't have that problem. But the solution of the automobile came along seemingly at just the right time. And that has me wondering if all these worries, I guess some people have, or at least predictions about what AI could do to our workforce. But if there's a whole segment of people who don't want to do the work, is this sort of like the automobile that AI is coming along at just the right time? Also, like the automobile, there were many unintended consequences. I suppose there's that worry here too.
Yeah, and I see so much of the talk about AI reflects like our misunderstanding of the value of work altogether. And like, if work really is essential to human dignity, to our
Which to, you believe it is.
I believe it is, to our sense of self-worth, that we're contributing something. Like what AI promises to do is free up all kinds of time so we don't have to work. Well, like there's not much dignity in being a consumer.
And it's interesting because most of the argument around this is, well, how are people going to get like money? And obviously, I don't think you discount that issue, but your issue is quite, but your concern is different than that.
Yeah. So I think like what AI will do, like any really powerful technology, is it concentrates wealth in the hands of the people who own and control the technology. And AI has the power of like vastly concentrating wealth. And so then arises the problem of, well, then how do we distribute the wealth somewhat equitably? And you have to do that to maintain a democracy. And if you don't, you end up with revolution. And so that's a real concern, because if we have profound dissatisfaction because of wealth inequity, we're going to run into really severe social problems. So that's an economic problem and a social problem we're going to have to solve. Is like AI is going to create new challenges for wealth distribution, and we'll have to figure it out. And I think there are plenty of people aware of that and are working on it. The problem I don't see much of is just this, like the inherent value of work. And I think there is an inherent value of work. Like if AI is doing the daily tasks that a whole bunch of people used to do, like how do we feel that we are contributing anymore to the well-being of society? And if I don't feel like I'm contributing, well, like, but I'm still getting some kind of benefit because we figured out the distribution problem. Say, if we do figure that out,
yeah,
I'm still benefiting from AI, but I'm not contributing in a proportional manner. Well, then I'm a parasite. And if I'm a parasite on society, like what's the dignity in that?
I mean, parasite's an intentionally strong word. But like last week, I was on vacation.
Yeah.
And I didn't do, I mean, I may have checked email a handful of times, but I wasn't like working. We were in Charleston, South Carolina, which if listeners have never been, it's a great place to go on vacation. We did normal vacation things. We went on a handful of tours. We did some things in the city, which were real interesting. We did some things outside of the city, which were very interesting. We ate at places we normally would never eat at. We stayed at a hotel. All those things, I didn't like think that was parasitic behavior. However, like if I was of the financial means to be living that life 52 weeks a year, which, you know, I'm not in that financial situation, but like I would do it. And I like, but you're saying that after like several of those weeks or months, I would just sort of like be unhappy? Because I'm not convinced I would.
You might be in a state of perpetual pleasant distraction.
That seems nice.
Well, I think it does to a lot of people, but a lot of people also get bored with it.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at what, like we're seeing increasing, really rapidly increasing rates of despair among young people. When we look at like the three big like measures of subjective well-being, anxiety, depression, despair, and loneliness. And like that's this depression, despair measure, when you look and you dig down into it, it's statements like, I don't matter to anybody. I don't contribute to anything. Nobody pays attention to what I'm saying. Because this is one of the things, like if you're you might hang out on the beaches and so forth, but nobody's calling you up to ask your advice or what you think about things. And, you know, like nobody really cares what you have to say. And so you might be eating great meals and be on the beach. For most people, that is really pleasant as long as it's a break from work. But as soon as it's not a break and it's just a way of life and really nobody cares about you anymore because you don't have anything to offer, then it's not so pleasant. I mean, there's still better and worse ways to spend a life of irrelevance, but it's still a life of irrelevance. And mm-hmm. most of us don't want that. We want to be relevant. We want to matter to somebody. And the only way of mattering is to contribute something, and that's what we call work. Like, there's a wide variety of that. Like, my dad was a house painter. I think for most of his life, he wished he was doing something else, and yet he also took great pride in doing his work really well. I think that's important, like this feeling that we're contributing something.
I remember when I was a kid, you know, and like any kid, you're sort of like trying to decide what you want to be when you grow up. And as a kid, I'm sure I didn't have like a complete view of all the different career paths and jobs that were out there, but I knew there were a lot. And I knew there were some I would be naturally interested in, some I would not be naturally interested in. But I remember thinking what amazed me in a way is that there really seemed to be people interested in all of these different idiosyncratic fields. And I'm not sure that probably is a little bit of a simplistic view back then, but at the same time, I think it can still be true in some ways. And I'll give you an example. So a friend of mine has worked in what I'll call, human services, for lack of a better term. He's worked in like group homes and assisting people, adults with developmental disabilities. And for a number of different reasons, he was looking for a different job in his town. And I happen to know that there was a job opening at the local bank. And I had a general idea of what kind of money he was hoping to make. And I said, hey, here's a job. And it was like about the amount of money he was looking for. It did. And this was, you know, he wasn't looking to make a ton of money at this point in his life. And like, this is, and it's, you know, he was qualified because the qualifications were fairly low. And we joke about banker's hours, but like these were literal banker's hours. And he, of course, had been working weekends and nights and all sorts of screwy things. And I'm like, gosh, I just think that you would want to, this seems like a, you know, I don't know if he'll get the job, but this seems like a great opportunity, right? And like, and if I were in his position, this is like what I would be hoping to do. And his response was, I mean, I don't think I'd be very happy doing that. I think I would miss working more. I mean, not that you don't work with people at a bank, but you're not, I mean, you're, you know, what going to a bank is like is very different than working with someone like the kind of work he's done. Mm-hmm. And he thought he would really miss that. And my response was, oh, I think I would like run away from that kind of work that you're doing into this type of thing. And he's like, no, I feel just the opposite. And I guess I just use that as an example that it is good and probably it would be like an awful world if all of us wanted to be the same kind of, have the same kind of job or had the same type of interest. So in some ways, that view I had as a youngster, that isn't it amazing that there's 150 million different jobs available and there happens to be 150 million people to fill these jobs, is sort of a minor miracle in a way.
It is. And you're one of the really fortunate people in life if you figure out a way to match your talents and your interests to the world's needs. You find yourself validated that way, but you spend your days doing something that you actually enjoy and is rewarding. When we look at studies of motivation, we find, and this comes from a study Frederick Hertzberger did years ago and published in the Harvard Business Review, and it's called the two-factor theory. And he distinguishes between what he calls motivation and what he calls hygiene. The things that make people unhappy with the work is deficiencies in hygiene. That is like when certain basic conditions and expectations aren't met. So things like the pay, the benefits, the working conditions, those sorts of things. If those are not sufficient, people are really dissatisfied. But it doesn't make them happy at work. So you don't increase people's happiness at work by paying them more, but you decrease dissatisfaction by paying people adequately. What makes people really highly motivated and energized at work is most often the work itself. They enjoy that kind of work. And so this is where you find somebody's interest really matches what their tasks are. But the other things are like recognition, achievement, input, opportunity for advancement or growth. I mean, these are the internal motivations that really make a difference. And so that's the difference between you and your friend, mm-hmm. like in different kinds of jobs. You might both stay at the job if you are paid a sufficient amount, but one of you would be happy and one of you would be unhappy at it, right?
So I guess maybe sort of to close this topic, although everyone who has a job gets a paycheck, and so it is at the end this transaction, and that you decide that your time is worth X, and your employer decides that what you produce is worth that amount for the company. I mean, there's a transactional thing there. And if you walked in tomorrow and said, I want to work half as much and get paid the same, or I want to do the same amount of work and get paid double, that you may not be around much longer. There is a transactional nature to it. But that's certainly not all that this is about, right? Is that these where we spend 40, sometimes more hours a week, although sort of starts at this transaction level, goes a whole lot deeper into who we are and really how happy we are in and outside of work.
Yes, and I just want to point out also that this discussion that we're having about like how important work is for our own dignity and so forth, this is a relatively recent discussion for most of human existence. And in most cultures, the root word for work is suffering. It took for pre-industrialization, it took so much labor just to survive, right? That life expectancy was fairly short and people were exhausted in pain for most of their lives.
Well, and it's funny you say that because I was chatting with somebody Monday, the day I got back from my vacation, and somebody said, "What are you up to today?" And I said, "Oh, you know, I was off all last week. I'm working today." And it was funny, as I was texting the word working, it made me think, you know, yes, I mean, I'm at my job. I'm doing work, but it's not that like work at one time was backbreaking, painstaking, awful, digging ditches work. And obviously, there's things at my job. I'm sure there's things at your job that you would just as soon not have to do. But like, it's not work like we used to think of it.
I have a friend who is about my age, but after he graduated from high school, he became a mason. So he was, you know, working with concrete and bricks, you know, his whole career. But by 45, his back and his knees were shot. And he ended up retiring early. He made a pretty good living at it. But like I would say from his mid-30s on, he's been in chronic pain, you know, and that's, I would say like that is the kind of work that like most human beings experience for most of human history. That now is the exception.
We had hundreds of years of building machines to make that the case.
Yes, yes. But we still talk, oftentimes we talk about work as if that's the only kind of work there is and like we just want to get rid of it. And there is this happy medium. And that's what I'm saying. Like we don't want to have work be so onerous, so difficult and hard that it's just a life of suffering. On the other hand, we do want to have an existence where we feel like we're genuinely contributing to others.
It really was clear to me when I started working as a young person in newspapers, which was really my first professional job. And before that, I had just worked retail and sort of these other, you know, part-time jobs. And I remember being at the newspaper office like the first week or two, like very new in the position. And it was like this is back when I was working second shift because we had to work into the evening to put the newspaper together because the press fired up about midnight. And there, I looked around and there were all these people of, you know, most older than me, some in their 40s and 50s, well into their careers, working these hours, really caring about the work they were doing. And it occurred to me, and it seems so simple looking back, but it's something I never really thought about, is that every one of these people wants to be here and wants to be doing this work. I mean, maybe not every second of their lives, but like in general. And that's so different than like when I was working part-time in retail where, you know, you get your schedule and you're like, oh, geez, I have to work Saturday night. Who could I find to work that shift? Because I'd rather be doing this. Or you just didn't really want to do the work, right? It was just like you had to do that. And I think for those who haven't been in lucky enough to be in a situation like mine, it is such a different experience to be in an environment surrounded by colleagues who enjoy the work, who realize it's important, and who want to be there.
It's interesting. Human beings, we are such adaptable creatures that even if we don't find the work itself to be intrinsically meaningful, if we're doing it under fairly good conditions with people that we enjoy their company, and we have some real input into how we do the job, we can find great meaning in it. And so that's a good thing.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, it's your turn to ask a question of me.
So, Scott, I was attending a fundraiser recently, and somebody I didn't know sat down at our table. This is one of these, it's a large room with a bunch of round tables. I think there was seating for eight, and we had four or five people sitting down. So this guy sits down. I didn't know who he was, but I assumed he maybe knew somebody else at the table. But he had been drinking quite a bit. He was very obnoxious. He would wave servers over to him. Most of the servers were young women. He would tell them dirty jokes and then give them extravagant tips. Just this kind of behavior I found like really offensive. And he was also spending a lot of money at this auction on bidding on things.
Which is part of the fundraising.
So he was contributing. Now, I don't have any official position. I'm just a guest like everybody else there. But I'm just wondering, like, do I have a responsibility to do something? He's making people around us uncomfortable. He's also making these servers uncomfortable, and I felt mostly bad for them. Do I have a responsibility to do something in this case, or should I just ignore him?
Well, what you should do is, you know, if you were 30 years younger, you would know exactly what to do, Rick. You would pull out your cell phone, you'd shoot a video, and then you'd post it online and then, you know...
And then publicly embarrass him.
That didn't occur to you?
That did not occur to me.
No. Now that I've mentioned it, was that something you would think about doing?
No.
Okay. Okay, so setting that idea aside, I think there's sort of two... You're right to sort of separate the people who are being affected. I mean, you and those around the table or elsewhere in the room who just are, like you said, rolling their eyes at this guy who's clearly had too much to drink and making a fool of himself, but also is there at a fundraiser actively helping this organization raise funds by buying drinks, which probably go help pay the bills and more importantly, bidding on this silent auction process. So I'm less worried about that part. Whoever's sponsoring this fundraiser does take some responsibility, I think, when they're serving alcohol that this could happen. And who knows? This guy could have had one drink at this event and had seven before ever showing up. So, I mean, it's hard to know where he got drunk. But I would not be especially bothered by how he's interacting with people like you. I think your concern is a little different when he's acting to the staff who are working this thing. If you did decide to like say something, would you have known who to tell though? I mean, it's not like if you're at like a restaurant, you can like, I want to speak to the manager and
right.
There is a manager, but like at a fundraiser, I don't know what that, there is no manager.
You have to kind of find out, well, like who's in charge, who's with the sponsoring organization.
But that person is probably at the front table or otherwise occupied, right?
Yeah, that's kind of problematic. And then one of the things that went through my mind is like, I don't know who he's connected. He kept dropping names of different people in the organization.
Okay, so he clearly didn't just walk in off the street. He has some connection to this group.
He seemed to. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, some people are name droppers and they drop the names without having the connection, but sometimes it's real. And so like you do you want to kind of report somebody who's got close ties with others yeah. when you're not affiliated
and
at all?
And maybe it's, and who knows, it could be the husband of the president of the organization. I mean, who only knows, right?
Yeah, yeah.
My initial thought would be, unless is that drunk people, and it sounds like in this case, this guy in particular, was not quiet. He was not being keeping things well to himself. You said that you're not part of this organization. You were just there as a community member. That there have to be other people in the room who are more connected to this event, who are witnessing this. Because it sounds like it's not just something that the two people on either side of him are aware of. I guess I would let the people who are in charge kind of determine if this was unacceptable behavior and what should be done. I probably, if I were in your situation, unless it got to the point of putting somebody's like physical physically at risk, I probably would not say or do much of anything other than, again, kind of like roll your eyes or, you know, maybe secretly film him and show somebody.
But you do think you should find somebody who like is connected with the organization?
No, I would assume that people who are connected with the organization are going to just notice him.
Just notice him.
And like, how many people were in the room total, roughly?
This is a big event. I would say about 250.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty big room.
And I guess that's sort of a judgment call. If you think what his behavior is like going to be witnessed broadly, and that if somebody who is in a position of some power could handle it, but let's be honest though. I mean, you could have written this dilemma. I mean, assuming this really happened to you.
Yeah.
But I mean, you could have written this dilemma saying you're an organizer of this fundraiser and there is a guy who's like laying out lots of money and is a longtime donor and is acting, you know, this way. What do you do? I mean, that's also, so that like puts the organizers in a dilemma as well, right?
Because and it was one of the things I was thinking, like if I go and report him, do they want to kick somebody out who might be a big funder, a big
exactly.
supporter?
Because yeah.
he seemed to be. I mean, he was certainly spending a lot of money. And so,
yeah. So that kind of puts them in a difficult spot, whether they're witnessing it from afar or whether you go up and approach them directly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what happened.
Yeah,
in
but
this
so
case.
I guess my answer specifically is I probably, unless it got awful, probably wouldn't do anything. But I'll be curious what really did happen.
Well, At first, I was kind of taking your response. I was reluctant to do much, although it was really bothering his behavior towards the server. And I said something to him about it, and he just got up and walked to a different table.
And presumably acted the same way.
Yeah, I looked over a couple times, and he was doing the same thing. And then one of the people from that table comes over and says, you got to do something about your friend, because they noticed that he'd come from our table. I said, like, none of us know who this guy was. And so then the two of us, and I think maybe somebody else, started walking around trying to find somebody from the organization and say, like, look, you got to do something about this guy. Especially his treatment of the servers is really inappropriate. So it took a while, and then I kind of, after reporting it, I thought, okay, that's my job. Mm-hmm. And I knew that some others had reported it too. But then after a while, I noticed that he was being escorted out.
Oh, wow.
I did find out later that he really had very little tie to the organization. He had somebody had invited him, but it was somebody that none of us knew, and I'm not sure who it was. He just turned out he had just drank way too much. But it bothered me for a long time that I was saying, like, should I have acted immediately and more forcefully on that? Because it took, I would say, almost an hour for this whole thing to work itself out. And because I think I think in that case, I was too tolerant of mm-hmm. the misbehavior.
Did you have that conversation, like, you know, I wish I would have done something sooner, with anybody else at the event after he was escorted out? And did other people sort of kind of say the same thing you did? Or did you have was that a conversation point among the people at your table or elsewhere?
Yeah. And I talked to a number of people who were at the organization the day after. Mm-hmm. And it turned out a lot of people were talking about this and were really bothered by it.
I mean, and there was some programming going on. I mean, if nothing else, it's a distraction from that, too.
Yeah. And here's one of the things that happens. Like, despite all the talk about the growing incivility in our society, at most events like this, people are really well-behaved.
Yeah.
And we don't come prepared to deal with somebody who doesn't follow the rules, mm-hmm. right? And so here's a guy who just didn't care, or he's oblivious, and he's just not. And you don't come in with the expectation that this is somebody we're going to have to deal with. So it takes a while to kind of figure it out on the fly, unless you've dealt with it in the past. So I just found it interesting that there was a whole bunch of people there that were really troubled by it and troubled by the fact that, like, he wasn't removed sooner, and yet it didn't happen. And I think one of the reasons it didn't happen is there were just so many people there.
Well,
right? And you keep thinking, like, somebody else is going to take care of this guy.
Well, and also, I mean, the planning for these events, and I'm sure you've been part of planning for similar events, is you do lots of work getting everything ready, but, like, that's not a situation you like have a plan for, I don't think, right? That you're like, well, and in case this happens, here's how we'll react. That's something that, and maybe it will be next time, but is nothing that's usually in sort of the run up to this that you talk much about.
Yeah, you usually don't hire a bouncer at these kinds of events because the bad behavior is so rare.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that, like, this is one of the how do you prepare for the foreseeable but not unlikely outcome?
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and also check out Rick's column about ethics, which can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.